You are listening to 93.3 WNRB LP Wausau. Free people, free radio.
And now, the man who brought down Nixon, Mike Cannon.
Okay, welcome to the second hour of this Indie Media Radio program, The Mike Cannon Show. Obviously, we ran out of time during the first hour to bring you most of the shorter pieces like Media Minutes and Women's E-News and all those shows I normally bring you, so we'll be bringing you them this hour. That'll happen after the piece I bring you each and every week at this time. Come up now is This Way Out, an LGBT news magazine. That's the type of alternative non-corporate program you get each and every week here on The Mike Cannon Show. Thanks for listening.
You take the blue pill. The story ends. You wake up in your bed and believe whatever you want to believe. You take the red pill. You stay in Wonderland. And I show you how deep the rabbit hole goes.
I felt overall there was a very genial sort of atmosphere. I also was utterly shocked by the amount of gay clergy I saw. it was stunning. I was like, I feel like I'm like at, you know, Fire Island or P-Town or something. There's just so many gay people here.
Welcome to This Way Out, the International Gay and Lesbian Radio Magazine. I'm Greg Gordon. Cayman's lawmakers rush to prevent couples equality. A pen friend lauds a lesbian writer's legacy. And human spirit meets Holy Spirit at the Anglican Lambeth Conference. All that and more this week because you've discovered This Way Out.
I'm Lee Moore.
And I'm Chris Wilson.
With NewsWrap, a summary of some of the news in or affecting the lesbian and gay community for the week ending September 13th, 2008. An amendment to legislation in the Cayman Islands defining marriage as between a man and a woman was approved this week by the British Territory's Legislative Assembly. Civil partnerships, giving same-gender couples most of the rights of marriage, took effect in the UK in late 2005, but the legislation did not extend to any of Britain's 14 territories, which include Gibraltar, the Falkland Islands, and the Caymans. None of them have moved to grant legal recognition to same-gender couples. Cayman opposition parties are calling for the law to be extended to ban civil partnerships. They fear the UK or the European Union may impose them at some point in the future. But leader of government business Kurt Tibbetts told the Caymanian Compass newspaper that if we were to define civil unions, it would mean we would condone them and accept them and allow them, he said, and I'm saying otherwise. Lesbi-gay issues have had a higher profile in the Caymans since May, when a U.S. tourist vacationing at the Royal Palms Resort was detained by an off-duty police officer for kissing his boyfriend. He was taken to the police station, reportedly, after other customers complained. The man was later released without charge, and the director of tourism sent a formal apology to him. But Tibbetts said while the Caymans welcome all tourists, the basis of this bill is not financial calculations. We don't set our family values based on how much money they make for us. Homosexual acts between consenting adults were decriminalized in the Caymans by a UK order in council in December 2000. The UK and the Caymans are due to begin talks about constitutional reform later this month.
A Lebanese woman and her Bulgarian partner, who were arrested when others complained about their making out on a beach in Dubai, were jailed for a month in early September after the Dubai Court of Appeal upheld a lower court ruling. They were convicted of committing indecent acts in public for kissing and fondling each other on Al Mamzar Beach. The local 7 Days newspaper said that the women will be deported after they serve their jail terms and noted that this was the first case of its kind in the United Arab Emirates, a federation of 7 city-states that includes Dubai. While it's a popular destination for tourists, and a majority of its 5.6 million residents are foreigners, Dubai is governed by Islamic law, and homosexual acts are a criminal offense. At least 40 men were arrested there in July for what Dubai's police chief called not respecting social values, and behaving like the opposite sex.
Posters advocating death to gays appeared around Sarajevo, Bosnia-Herzegovina, in early September in advance of the nation's first lesbi-gay pride activities. 3 days of events are scheduled to begin on September 24th. They happen to coincide with the Muslim holy month of Ramadan and have been angrily denounced by some imams and politicians as immoral and contrary to the teachings of the Quran. Sarajevo is at least 85% Muslim. The posters were condemned by local human rights activists. One of Sarajevo's leading intellectuals, law professor Dragov Grebo, told the Associated Press that the organizers should have taken Muslim concerns into consideration. "Why this finger right in the eye?" he asked. However, he said, it's not a reason to cancel it. Bosnia-Herzegovina is not in the European Union, although it's seeking membership. But the EU has called sexual orientation-based discrimination in the country widespread.
A cabaret featuring performers from London, Amsterdam, and Berlin is scheduled to run throughout 5 days of Pride events in the coming week in Serbia's capital of Belgrade, according to a report by PinkNews.com. Organizers are only using a website to communicate details about each event for safety reasons, an indication of the climate for the country's LGBT people. A large group of neo-fascist and religious fundamentalists violently attacked marchers during Belgrade's first-ever Pride parade in 2001. A subsequent event was canceled because organizers couldn't guarantee participant safety. This year's Pride website says, "We have a new concept. We refuse to spend time on worries about violence that might happen and hiring private security or police." Serbia, which is not in the European Union, is one of the continent's least accepting of LGBT people, according to a European Commission report on human rights published last year.
But annual LGBT Pride festivities kicked off in Taiwan's capital city of Taipei this week and will culminate with Asia's largest Pride march on September 27th. Last year's parade drew about 15,000 people, and organizers are expecting up to 20,000 this year. About 500 people marched in Taipei's first Pride parade in 2002. Among several Pride-related events, an online essay contest is being held with the title of My Gay Friend. Government officials will select 5 winning entries and include them in a booklet on lesbi-gay life in Taipei, which the city plans to publish annually. Compared to most of its Asian neighbors, social acceptance of gays and lesbians in Taiwan has grown considerably in this decade, most notably in Taipei. While activists remain frustrated over stalled national equality legislation, a number of LGBT cafes and bookstores are reportedly flourishing in the city.
In the U.S., a Florida judge has ruled that the state's 31-year ban on adoptions by gays and lesbians is unconstitutional. The decision by Judge David Odlin Jr. will allow an openly gay Key West man to adopt the teenage boy that he's raised as a foster parent since 2001. Odlin appointed the foster father to be the boy's legal guardian in 2006. The teen has learning disabilities and special needs, so it's unlikely that a heterosexual couple would want him. At a hearing earlier this year, according to a report in the Miami Herald, the boy testified that he wanted the man to be his forever father because I love him. Judge Odlin said that the adoption by the Key West man and his partner was in the child's best interests. He said that barring gays and lesbians from adopting conflicted with the state constitution because it targets a specific group and prevents family courts and child welfare judges from deciding on a case-by-case basis what's best for the child. The law was passed during Anita Bryant's infamous anti-queer crusade in 1977. Attempts to repeal it have failed several times in the legislature. Odlin's ruling, however, is unlikely to be cited as a precedent in future cases. And if it is, legal analysts say, it's likely to be appealed. Mississippi is the only other U.S. state that specifically forbids gays and lesbians from adopting children.
Maryland's highest court, the State Court of Appeals, this week ruled against a referendum proposing to repeal gender identity anti-bias protections in Montgomery County, which is just north of Washington, D.C. The Montgomery County Council voted unanimously last year to add gender identity as a protected class to its civil rights law. Charging that the addition of gender identity would create confusion in public restrooms and health club locker rooms, Citizens for Responsible Government immediately began collecting signatures to block the statute from going into effect. This week's Court of Appeals decision reversed a lower court ruling that the LGBT advocacy group Equality Maryland had missed the deadline to challenge the validity of the petition signatures that had qualified the measure for the ballot. The High Court heard arguments on September 8th and had to rule quickly because state officials were required to certify language for the November 4th ballot by September 10th. The justices only issued a brief order reversing the lower court ruling, promising a fuller explanation of the decision later. Lambda Legal had joined Equality Maryland in the lawsuit. Natalie Chin, a Lambda Legal staff attorney, told reporters that the bottom line is that the court said a petition sponsor shouldn't be allowed to cut corners and circumvent legal requirements to get a referendum attacking minority protections on the ballot. We are very happy that this duly enacted law can take effect and protect a vulnerable group of Montgomery County residents.
Mexico City's legislature passed a law earlier this month making it easier for transgender people to legally change their names and obtain revised birth certificates reflecting their chosen gender identity. Laws had already allowed people to do that, but because there were no specific rules, the process could take years to wind through the courts. The new law formalizes the procedure for name changes and lets people ask a judge for new birth certificates. Mexico City's leftist government last year enacted civil unions legislation for same-gender couples.
And finally, a church in South Africa has been fined for firing a music teacher in 2005 because he was in a gay relationship. The country's Christian Democratic Party and the Apostolic Faith Mission Church have expressed alarm over the recent Pretoria High Court ruling. Officials from the party and the church said that while the South African Constitution prohibits discrimination based on sexual orientation, it also protects freedom of association and religion, and that the former should not trump the latter. Apostolic Faith President Dr. Isaac Berger told reporters that Christian values should not be subject to an extremely secular and liberal constitution, that is, he said, above the Bible and God. But the court ruled that the Dutch Reformed Church Moreletta Park had discriminated against Johan Strydom, must publicly apologize to him, and must pay him the equivalent of about $11,200 for impairment of his dignity, emotional and psychological suffering, and loss of earnings. While expressing its disagreement with the ruling, the church said this week that it had decided not to appeal because the congregation had enough opportunity to testify on the Bible's view on the dangers of homosexuality.
That's News Wrap for the week ending September 13th, 2008, written by Greg Gordon and recorded at the studios of KPFK Los Angeles.
Follow the news in your area and around the world. An informed community is a strong community. For This Way Out, I'm Lee Moore.
And I'm Chris Wilson.
The lesbian scientist who cured thousands of Africans and the sexy and not-so-sexy sides of a big bishop's bash. Later in the program. In this portrait of a friendship, This Way Out queer lit commentator Janet Mason pays tribute to the life and work of lesbian author Toni Brown.
A true friend is hard to lose. The loss is palpable, like some previously unknown core at the center of you is suddenly ripped out, howling and empty. This is how I felt when my good friend, the lesbian writer, Toni Brown, died on April 17, 2008. She was 55 years old. Toni and I were close friends for nearly 20 years. We met several years before she moved to Philadelphia. At the time, she lived in Amherst, Massachusetts, and was a member of a Northampton lesbian writers group. We met through a mutual friend who was in the Philadelphia Feminist Writers Group with me at the Outright Conference, an LGBT writing conference held at that time in Boston. A year or so later, my Philadelphia writing group went to Northampton to give a reading. I stayed at Toni's house in Amherst and took her large, gentle German shepherd named Zen for a walk. Zen led me into the garden at the Emily Dickinson house, where he made a reservation for the two writing groups, now one large group, at least for the duration of our stay. I remember all of us sitting in the large Victorian sitting room. The drapes were drawn, and there was a hush surrounding the words of the tour guide, who carefully left out any mention of Emily's lesbian passions. Now, reflecting back on that afternoon, I see that there was something prophetic about it. We were surrounded by the ghostly presence of Emily Dickinson, even as we laughed and posed for pictures. At the same time that the pictures were taken in the Dickinson Garden some 20 years ago, Tony had a short afro. A year later, when she moved to Philadelphia, she began locking her hair, always, it seemed, twisting the tiny nubs until they grew down below her shoulders. Tony's work was published in Sinister Wisdom, Prairie Schooner, and the American Poetry Review, among other places. Her words are the quiet hush around the storm, a keen and often painful observation of detail, insight into injustice in its many forms, and at the same time a testament to love, to all that is good in the world. Her work is transcendent, just as Tony was in her life. I cannot stop my mind from trying to search for answers or for meaning. One thing that I am certain of is that I was fortunate to have Tony Brown for my friend. Several summers ago, we spent time together in Provincetown, Massachusetts, a favorite place for both of us, and especially for Tony, who grew up in Boston. One night we found a karaoke drag bar, the audience filled with primarily straight couples, for some reason, and the two of us got up to sing California Dreaming. As we stood back to back, our shoulders touching as we turned our heads to look at each other as we sang. Later that year, in the fall, we gave our last reading together with women from Tony's old writing group at an art gallery in Northampton, Massachusetts. Members of the Philadelphia Writers Group had gone our separate ways, falling out of touch because of our busy schedules. But suddenly, we are back in each other's lives. We tell the old stories and look at the old photos of our trip to Northampton 20 years ago, when we stood in Emily Dickinson's garden so happy with ourselves and with each other. When we look at the photos and see our younger selves with a younger Tony, with her short afro, we are looking at someone who is now absent. She is the part of our laughter that is gone. This is Janet Mason with commentary on queer life and literature for This Way Out.
Dr. Louise Pierce, renowned woman scientist of her time, coming up now on the Rainbow Minute. Louise Pierce was born in Massachusetts in 1885 and was one of the first women to earn a degree in physiology. She earned her medical degree from Johns Hopkins 5 years later. Pierce was one of the leading women scientists of the early 20th century. She traveled to the Belgian Congo with drugs she'd helped develop to treat African sleeping sickness. She tested it on 70 patients with miraculous results. The drug eradicated the parasitic disease within weeks, eliminating symptoms and restoring general health in even extreme cases, curing over 100,000 Africans. Belgian officials awarded her the Ancient Order of the Crown of Belgium. Pierce spent her last years in New Jersey sharing a home with author Ida A.R. Wiley and noted New York City health physician Josephine Baker. The Rainbow Minute is produced by Judd Proctor and Brian Burns and recorded in the studios at WRIR in Richmond, Virginia, and read by volunteers like me, Mary Gay Hutchison.
Hello, this is the actor Michael Emerson. I play Ben on Lost. It's not easy being one of the others, so if time travel or moving the island isn't an option and you're feeling sort of lost, try listening to Greg and Lucia on This Way Out, the international LGBT radio magazine.
You'll find a new This Way Out update in your email inbox soon with news about podcasts and altered states. If you're not signed up to get it, email tworadio@aol.com.
I went to the Lambeth Conference where I got to see a lot of bishops wearing very colorful frocks.
Last time on This Way Out, ex-gay activist and performance artist Peterson Toscano gave a rousing description of the once-a-decade Lambeth Conference of Anglican Bishops. That mid-August gathering in England was expected to be a make-or-break event for the worldwide Anglican Communion. The 2004 consecration of openly gay Bishop of New Hampshire Gene Robinson and the blessing of same-gender couples in Canada and the U.S. have been the main targets of schism-threatening conservatives in the church. In the conclusion of his conversation with Heather Kitching, Toscano shares more about the human approach that transformed a potentially explosive situation.
And how did the media coverage and the fact that Lambeth was happening affect the public discourse? I mean, aside from the media coverage, what about, you know, talk show debates, letters to the editor? Were you seeing a lot of public debate happening around the whole thing?
Yeah, I couldn't help but notice it even when I was in Guernsey, and even in their little local paper there, there were articles, there were letters about Lambeth. It is the Church of England, and so it affected, even though a lot of people don't attend the Church of England, it definitely was an English story that was very much in the press. There were always letters to the editors, always opinion pieces in the papers. Anytime I saw the news, there was something about what was going on at Lambeth. So it really captured the attention of people there. And when I was even going through immigration at one point, coming back from Guernsey, and they're like, "Why are you here?" I was like, "Well, I'm here for the Lambeth Conference." And they're like, "Wow, are you a bishop?" I'm like, "Yeah, right."
Wow. So did you actually attend any of Robinson's events? I mean, you said that you had competing events one day, but did you get to see any of the speeches that he made?
No, because he only had that one that that was at the same time that I was there, was when we had the competing event. Other than that, I a lot of his were closed door sort of things where he was meeting with people, and he actually had lots of conversations with individual bishops. Which was great because things happened on campus, but things happened off campus too, and it was not surprising to see bishops down in Canterbury walking around the streets and all. So he had events with folks there. But what I got to witness was, again, like I said, these other folks, some of whom have been preparing for this event for 10 years.
Mm-hmm.
There were groups there that, you know, had themselves together. They were communicating with people. They were lobbying, they were connecting, they were working hard to persuade people to listen to their stories. And I think they had a great impact, much more than the media covered and is aware of.
Mm-hmm. Was there much of an anti-gay presence there? I mean, as you pointed out, a lot of the anti-gay folks chose to forego the event, but did many come?
I think it was pretty clear the most anti-gay people chose not to come. And so as a result, you had some more moderate people or just people who were just like, why are we even talking about this issue when there's so much poverty going on and there's AIDS and there's other stuff that we need to be talking about? There was also a lot of talk. I mean, this wasn't just about the ordination of gays that was an issue. It was ordination of women was another big issue. There was a whole day about women's issues and spousal abuse and discussions about things like that. So I felt overall there was a very genial sort of atmosphere. I also was utterly shocked by the amount of gay clergy I saw. it was stunning. I was like, I feel like I'm like at, you know, Fire Island or P-Town or something. There's just so many gay people here. And it was really, really stunning. And it's one thing I said recently to a clergy member who's anti-gay. I said, you know, I know you push us out of your churches, but like it or not, we're still having church with or without your permission. And without openly ordaining us, there are still plenty of lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgender people serving in the Anglican Church.
Mm-hmm. So what was your sense of what the outcome was at the Lambeth Conference? I mean, did you have a sense that they did discuss the gay issue in detail, and did they come to some kind of resolution after, you know, there's been such a lead up to this for so many months and years that this was going to be the big showdown about queer issues? You know, has there been a resolution?
Yeah, it didn't. I mean, there's nothing decisive that was done. I think one thing that did happen, and again, it's not particularly sexy, but relationships were built. And, you know, the bottom line, that's the most important thing in any kind of activism, that you build relationships, that people get humanized on both ends of the struggle. And this is going to go on. And I think people heard stuff that was difficult to hear. About churches who in Nigeria that were threatened to be bombed because Gene Robinson was ordained as a bishop when that happened. And you know, just because that there were so many anti-gay forces in that city that they thought, well, this is an anti-gay institution, and people's lives were at risk because of that. And that's not a part of the story that we often hear in this, that there are local challenges that the people face that, you know, that can really affect them. So I think people got to have a chance to have a good hearing of a lot of the issues, and it's incredibly complex, and I don't think they're going to come to a quick conclusion at any time soon.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just going to be further talking, further waiting, and hopefully some intervisitation that will happen so that some more of the American clergy will go to parts of Africa and South America. And it's funny because I'm a Quaker, and we have a very similar struggle globally. I mean, a lot of people think Quakers are like, wow, they're the cool people that welcome everybody in. But there are evangelical Quaker churches in North America, in Africa, in South America, that are not welcoming yet of gays and lesbians. Some are, but many of them are not. And we're having the same struggle, and people saying, should we not associate with these people anymore? What do we do? And as a result, there's been a big inter-visitation campaign where people are visiting each other's meeting and sitting and talking and getting face-to-face with our opponents and seeing that, hey, they're people like we're people. And I think that's so critical in the work of activism, so that we're not always demonizing the other.
Mm-hmm. Cool. So what... are you planning your own activism out of this, or are you planning to follow up in any way from this trip?
Well, I'm not an Anglican, so it's really kind of funny that I was invited in the first place. I never, you know, pursued it. It was a personal friend of Rowan Williams, the Archbishop of Canterbury, who had seen me perform and said, it would be great if you can come to Lambeth, and this was 3 years ago. And I was like, sure, if you want me. And I really thought he was just chatting me up, you know. I was just like, yeah, whatever. And then, you know, in the fall, I got, you know, the email saying, we're ready to make arrangements for you to come. So I felt honored to be part of that, but I don't feel personally a part in the Anglican worldwide community. But I think it has helped to reinforce the idea of what I do with BeyondXGay.com and the work that we're doing working with ex-gay survivors, that ultimately the best data that we can provide for anyone is our own story.
Mm-hmm.
And that's so powerful when we can vulnerably, clearly tell our story. And I keep on thinking of the words of Langston Hughes' poem, I Too, where he talks about how he wasn't allowed to sit at the table and sent to eat in the kitchen. And this is a man who's a black man living in a very white America, but also a gay man living in a very straight America. And the very end of the line, end of the poem, he says, besides, they'll see how beautiful we are and be ashamed. And I think ultimately that is what's going to happen in these churches that are so intolerant. They're going to see their own sons and daughters who are lesbian and gay and see the beauty in them. And they're going to turn. And, of course, not all do. And it's at their own loss and poverty. But more and more, I think we're seeing that. And I think that, more than anything else, is moving people along, just seeing what we bring to the church, what we bring to our communities, that we're not who they've been told we were. They've been given misinformation. We can counter those lies with the truth of our lives.
That was ex-gay activist performer Peterson Toscano talking about the Anglican Bishop's Lambeth Conference with This Way Out correspondent Heather Kitching. Thanks for choosing This Way Out, the international lesbian and gay radio magazine. This week, Lee Moore, Chris Wilson, Rex Wachner with Bill Kelly, Janet Mason, Judd Proctor, and Brian Burns with Mary Gay Hutcherson, and Heather Kitching contributed program material. Kim Wilson composed and performed our theme music. This Way Out is supported by charitable donations from our listeners. Thank you. Please log on to thiswayout.org. You can also subscribe to CDs or cassettes of all our programs there. To receive our weekly email alerts or the next This Way Out update, email tworadio@aol.com. You can also write to us at P.O. Box 38327, Los Angeles, California, 90038, USA. For Associate Producer Lucia Chappell and everyone at This Way Out, I'm Greg Gordon. Thanks for listening on CJAM Windsor, Ontario, WZKW Kingsville, Ohio, KBOO Portland, Oregon, and more than 175 other stations around the world, including this community radio station. And we're all gonna stay tuned.
And now, the only radio commentator not addicted to illegal pain medication, nor Viagra, Mike Cannon.
The Mike Cannon Show, normally heard Mondays from 2 to 6.
My thanks to Mike Cannon at WNRB in Wausau, Wisconsin, who rebroadcast World Report.
Welcome to Media Minutes. Welcome to the weekly radio spin, a look at the stories behind the news, brought to you by the Center.
Peak Oil Check-In, exploring the end of the age of cheap oil.
Women's E-News, weekly summary of news about women, women's issues, and from women's perspectives. From the weekly Cheers...
This Week in Radical History for the week of April 7th.
My name is Scooter, and this is the Innerside Radio Program.
This Week in Palestine, the service of the International Middle East Media Center.
Thanks for choosing This Way Out on WNRB, Wausau, Wisconsin.
All these programs and more can be heard each week on the Mike Cannon Indie Media Radio Show, normally heard every Monday from 2 to 6 p.m., right here on Central Wisconsin's only non-corporate, commercial-free community radio station, 93.3 WNRB LP, Wausau. Free people, free radio.
Welcome to Media Minutes, a weekly review of news related to media and democracy. I'm Stevie Converse.
And I'm Candace Clement. The Hollywood studios and major record labels are seeking a new weapon in their battle with copyright infringers, the Department of Justice. Senate Bill S-3325, the Enforcement of Intellectual Property Rights Act of 2008, would dramatically shift intellectual property enforcement by allowing the Department of Justice to bring civil suits against alleged infringers, altering the amount of evidence needed to prove a copyright violation, all at the expense of the American taxpayer. Sherwin C., staff attorney for Public Knowledge, a D.C.-based public interest group that works to defend citizens' rights in the emerging digital culture, explains.
The basic idea behind it is to increase penalties for IP infringement, and also to give law enforcement and copyright holders more tools to enforce it. The problem with it is that a lot of times those tools go too far or lead to an unbalanced approach to IP law.
C says that the main problem with the bill, which has passed out of committee, has to do with allowing the federal government to sue copyright infringers in civil court instead of prosecuting them criminally.
Under a civil suit, you have a lower burden of proof, whereas if you're being charged with a crime, you have to be found guilty beyond a reasonable doubt. In a civil suit, you only have to be found liable by a preponderance of the evidence, just if you're more likely than not to have infringed.
In a civil suit, the defendant loses many of the protections granted in a criminal suit, such as the right to free legal representation. In a letter sent to the Senate by 12 public interest groups, including the American Library Association, Electronic Frontier Foundation, and the Medical Library Association, the groups explained that the bill would be an enormous gift of federal resources to large copyright owners. They argue that the movie and television producers, software music, and print publishers all have their own enforcement programs in place. Need proof? According to Public Knowledge, the recording industry alone has threatened or filed more than 30,000 lawsuits against individual consumers in the past 5 years.
Basically, this is deputizing the Department of Justice to do for copyright holders what copyright holders can already do themselves.
To find out more or to contact your senator about the Enforcement of Intellectual Property Rights Act of 2008, visit publicknowledge.org. The democratic process has always relied on access to information and multiple points of view, and in an election year, this connection is even more apparent. Common Cause has put out a new media reform plan that outlines the problems with the American media system and suggests some direct solutions. John Bartholomew works on media issues for Common Cause.
We started working on this report this summer in the intention to release it just before both the Republican and Democratic National Conventions so that then this would be something we could distribute to the media covering the conventions, get it in the hands of the delegates, and many of whom are members of Congress, so that they can start discussing these issues at that national level, but also in that grassroots level and on the netroots, too.
The group's media reform plan lays out concrete problems, such as massive consolidation of newspaper, radio, and television, the importance of public interest obligations for broadcasters, the value of a free and open internet, and the need for independent media. Common Cause also published an extensive appendix on campaign contributions by media corporations, telephone and cable industry, and trade organizations such as the National Association of Broadcasters. Working with the Center for Responsive Politics, Common Cause tallied up contributions from various lobbying firms and individual companies, and then looked at every single candidate to report how much money each member of Congress has received in the past few years.
Of course, the top ones are the candidates for president: Hillary Clinton, Barack Obama, John McCain. You know, Rudy Giuliani is in the top six for receiving money from these interests. But, for example, the ranking Republican on the Senate Commerce Committee, Ted Stevens, $140,000 in the last two election cycles from telecommunications interests. And you have to ask yourself why they're donating this kind of money. And one of the more fascinating things about it was that it's almost exactly balanced between the two parties.
To find out more about the media reform plan and other work done by Common Cause, visit CommonCause.org.
You've been listening to Media Minutes, a production of Free Press, a national nonpartisan organization working to reform the media. For more information, visit freepress.net.
Welcome to the Weekly Radio Spin, a look at the stories behind the news, brought to you by the Center for Media and Democracy. I'm Diane Farsetta.
And I'm Judith Sears Poisson. In our top spin, the near collapse of U.S. mortgage giants Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac did benefit a few people. In a bid to hold onto their golden parachutes, or millions of dollars in severance payments, the former mortgage company CEOs hired well-connected corporate fixers. Freddie Mac's former executive hired the head of the public relations firm Sard Verbinnen. The firm has worked for home living guru Martha Stewart and ex-New York Governor Eliot Spitzer. Fannie Mae's former executive hired high-profile Washington lawyer Robert Barnett. He's worked for Republican strategist Karl Rove and both Bill and Hillary Clinton. The U.S. government, which now controls Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, denied their former executives their golden parachutes. However, each was allowed to keep millions in pensions and 401k plans.
In Bolivia, dozens of people have been killed in violent anti-government protests. President Evo Morales claimed the protesters were receiving support from the United States and told the U.S. ambassador to leave the country. The U.S. government responded by ousting the Bolivian ambassador. Now the U.S. Agency for International Development, or USAID, wants to smooth things over with public relations. USAID is looking for a PR firm to promote its work in Bolivia, highlighting emergency relief, economic, and social welfare programs. The agency plans to spend $500,000 on PR in Bolivia over the next year. USAID is one of the U.S. agencies accused of funding the opposition groups. Earlier this year, U.S. Peace Corps volunteers and a Fulbright scholar admitted that the U.S. Embassy in Bolivia had repeatedly asked them to spy on people.
Remember the Swift Boat Veterans for Truth? In 2004, the fact-challenged group launched several attack ads against then-Democratic presidential candidate John Kerry. Now, many of the same people have a new group that's running attack ads against Barack Obama. The new group is called the American Issues Project. Here's a clip from its first ad, which refers to former Weather Underground radical turned education professor Bill Ayers.
Barack Obama is friends with Ayers, defending him as, quote, respectable and mainstream. Obama's political career was launched in Ayers' home, and the two served together on a left-wing board. Why would Barack Obama be friends with someone who bombed the Capitol and is proud of it?
The Obama campaign has called the ad false and despicable. Barack Obama has condemned Ayers' past and pointed out that Ayers was part of the Weather Underground when Obama was 8 years old. In addition to opposing Obama, the American Issues Project supports drilling for oil offshore and in Alaska and converting coal to liquid fuel.
Everyone agrees that the Food and Drug Administration, or FDA, should help people to understand direct-to-consumer drug ads.
The problem is, who's helping the FDA do that? The agency recently launched a website titled Be Smart About Prescription Drug Advertising. The information on the site was provided for free by a group called Ethic Ad. Ethic Ad is funded by and housed in the offices of a public relations firm that helps pharmaceutical companies launch new drugs. The watchdog group Center for Science in the Public Interest is calling on the FDA to trash the website and start over, with help from doctors, pharmacists, and consumer groups. It said the FDA's new website isn't misleading, but it is filled with jargon. It also doesn't have any information about how to evaluate the claims made in drug ads or how to interpret messages about drug side effects.
And now it's time to play 6 Degrees of Spin and Fakin, our look at the connections between media manipulators. Earlier, we mentioned the political attack group American Issues Project. Two of the group's organizers are Chris LaCivita and Tony Feather. Both are employees of the Republican lobbying firm DCI Group. The DCI Group has helped form several industry-funded front groups over the years. In the 1990s, when Microsoft was facing antitrust charges, DCI helped the company create two front groups, the Association for Competitive Technology and Americans for Technology Leadership. The latter group waged a campaign to get people to send letters supporting Microsoft to state attorneys general. The campaign, and Microsoft's role in it, was exposed when some letters were sent in the names of dead people.
That's this week's edition of the Weekly Radio Spin. For more information, visit the Center for Media and Democracy's website at www.prwatch.org.
Women's E-News, weekly summary of news about women, women's issues, and from women's perspectives. From the weekly Cheers and Jeers column of September 20th, 2008, I'm Sandy Billings. Let's start with the good news. Cheers! Rwandan women gained seats at the table. Following elections on September 18th, Rwanda is the first nation in the world where women outnumber men in parliament. Women now account for at least 55% of the lower chamber in Rwanda, according to provisional results. Previously, they held 48% of seats. Female lawmakers earned 20 seats in direct elections. Another 24 were already secured in an indirect vote. Rwanda now has a higher number of female lawmakers than Sweden, where 47% of parliamentarians are women. This is the second election that has taken place since the 1994 genocide, which cost 800,000 lives. Women have staked a strong role in rebuilding the country under President Paul Kagame's leadership and represent 55% of the nearly 5 million registered voters there. More news to cheer this week. In Israel, the ruling Kadima Party elected Foreign Minister Tzivi Livni as the country's next prime minister after she narrowly ousted Ehud Olmert in the party's election. Livni has 42 days to form a new ruling coalition. Failure could trigger early elections in 2009. If she succeeds, Livni will become Israel's first female prime minister since Golda Meir stepped down in 1974. The U.S. Food and Drug Administration has approved the use of Gardasil HPV vaccine to protect against vulvar and vaginal cancers. The vaccine was developed to prevent cervical cancer and genital warts caused by some strains of human papillomavirus. A Melbourne, Australia bar has been ordered to stop offering $50 drinking vouchers to women who take off their knickers. A No Undie Sunday event also provided women with free drinks if they flashed the bartenders. A liquor licensing official said the plan was not in the public interest. And now for the Jeers column, world leaders fall short. Governments around the world are failing to live up to their commitments to equality for women, and they must step up their efforts. This, according to the United Nations in a UNIFEM report. The report was released ahead of a meeting this coming week in which world leaders are to assess progress on the Millennium Development Goals. These goals include improving women's rights, reducing maternal and child deaths, achieving universal education, and reducing global poverty. In terms of women's status specifically, the UNIFEM report said matters were urgent and there is an accountability crisis in getting governments to keep their promises to women and assessing their records of action. If promises were kept, the world would see better progress in achieving all the development goals. UNIFEM Executive Director Inez Alberdi said, quote, "Without putting in place strong measures to track progress on gender equality, we run the risk that commitments such as the Millennium Development Goals will remain words on paper," end quote. The report, titled Who Answers to Women, cites significant gaps for women. They are outnumbered 4-to-1 in legislatures. 60% of unpaid family workers are female. Women earn 17% less than men. One-third of women suffer some form of gender-based violence. And 500,000 women die from childbirth annually, a rate that's shrinking by less than 0.5% each year. More news to jeer this week. A female suicide bomber detonated and killed 22 people in Diyala in northern Iraq. More than 24 female suicide bombings have been reported this year. Iraq's Minister for Women's Affairs, Nawal al-Samari, warned of a disaster if more was not done to assert women's rights, saying militants often tap illiterate women who have lost their relatives in the war. The proportion of homeless women and the elderly is increasing in Vancouver. A city count found that 600 women among the 2,660 homeless people in one night. That's a higher percentage of women than a year ago. Older women are especially vulnerable because they are less likely to have pensions and retirement savings than men. A Griffith University Violence Research and Prevention Program study found that 20% of intimate partner homicides in Australia are committed by women. The report also found that abused women who murder their partners often act in extreme fear and desperation. The study showed that over 3/4 of women who killed their husbands were raped by them, and 39% had been raped more than 20 times. Google has been forced to accept advertising that attacks abortion rights, a result of a suit brought by a British anti-choice group, the Christian Institute. Google had a policy of banning ads that mixed religion and abortion, but the lawsuit argued that it was a violation of Britain's Equality Act. As part of the settlement, Google will now accept religious ads that discuss abortion in a factual way. The policy change takes place worldwide. A Ugandan official wants to ban women from wearing miniskirts because they cause accidents by distracted drivers who may be mentally weak. Wearing the short skirts is indecent, said Nasaba Botero, Uganda's ethics minister. Also noted in the news this week, divorce rates in Kolkata, India have tripled in 2 years. As a result of more divorces across the nation, the social stigma is decreasing and even being trumpeted as proof of women's advancement in newspaper headlines. We should celebrate rising divorce rates, one tabloid announced. A hotel in Marmaris, Turkey fired all its male employees after the manager became fed up with how they flirted with female guests. In June, the female boss saw too many male bartenders socializing with foreign women to tolerate. She decided that only women will work at the hotel, picking up jobs normally reserved for men. These news briefs were compiled by Dominique Sogel and Jennifer Thurston. Rita Henley-Jensen is the editor-in-chief. This production of Women's E-News is brought to you by VP Foundation and Yin Radio. Background music is by Joan Hickey. This column and more news about women can be found at the Women's E-News website, womensenews.org. For Yin Radio, I'm Sandy Billings.
Peak Oil Check-In, exploring the end of the age of oil.
Reports of gasoline shortages in the wake of Hurricanes Gustav and Ike rolled in last week and over the weekend from throughout the southeastern United States. A Tallahassee, Florida TV station reported that 80 to 90% of local gas stations were out of gas on Monday. South Carolina Now Multimedia News reported some gas stations there were running out of product, and prices rose up to 80 cents per gallon in 24 hours as Ike approached Galveston and Houston last week. As far north as Maryland, the Baltimore Sun reports, a convenience store chain said 25 of its 30 stores in the region were out of gasoline. And west to Knoxville, Tennessee, gas pumps were closed, and those stations that had gas were selling it for up to $5.50 a gallon, according to a comment posted to the website theoildrum.com. And yet, oil prices have dropped, closing below $100 a barrel on Monday for the first time in half a year. What's going on? Well, I'll begin with a caveat. We can observe prices and note what else is happening in the world, and then try to tell a story that makes sense of it all. A lot of things are happening at once, however, and controlled experiments just aren't possible. That said, what's a plausible explanation for falling world oil prices while gasoline prices are rising and shortages are occurring in parts of the U.S.? Paradoxically, the same supply and demand forces explain both trends. Gasoline is in short supply because Gulf Coast refineries closed down in preparation for Hurricane Gustav, and then again for Ike. Some refineries didn't start running again between the landfall of the two hurricanes, and many of them still haven't reopened, as of Monday.
Gulf Coast refineries supply gasoline and other refined petroleum products to pipelines serving much of the U.S. The U.S. also imports a lot of gasoline refined abroad through ports in New Orleans and other parts of the Gulf Coast. Most of the refineries are expected to be running again within 1 or 2 weeks. Some expect it to take considerably longer than that to relieve gas shortages and bring the price back down. John Hoffmeister, former president of Shell Oil, told the Washington Times that he expects the U.S. to be in what he says is a world of hurt from gasoline shortages for the next 4 to 6 weeks. He called for gasoline rationing not only in the Southeast, but as far north and west as Denver and the upper Midwest. So that's easy enough to understand. The weather takes out gasoline supplies, so prices increase. How come oil prices continue to fall then? That's also related to supply and demand. It's refineries that buy crude oil, not consumers. The hurricanes closed over a dozen refineries, so they weren't buying crude oil. The economy is slowing down in the U.S. and other major industrial nations, which also puts downward pressure on crude prices. Of course, the Gulf hurricanes also shuttered nearly all of the U.S. Gulf of Mexico oil production facilities, and a couple oil platforms were reported to be adrift after Ike passed through. I haven't yet seen a detailed damage assessment. So while oil production is temporarily down in the Gulf, apparently it's not down enough to boost world oil prices. Oil is a limited resource, and the world may already have passed the peak in oil production. The gasoline shortages we're seeing now and how they play out in the rest of the economy can give us a taste of what we're likely to experience as world oil production declines. Strangely enough, the gasoline futures market seems to expect the effects of the hurricane to have dissipated by next month. October gasoline futures continue to drop, and they're almost below $2.50 a gallon. To translate that into price paid at the pump, add 80 cents or so for state and federal taxes and other factors. But it's still quite a drop for regions experiencing gas at $5.50 a gallon, when it's available at all. If the future traders are right, we can expect abundant gasoline supply and lower prices before the November U.S. elections. The Kingdom of Saudi Arabia, whose leaders enjoy close ties with George W. Bush's family, resisted calls to cut production made by other OPEC member nations at a meeting on September 9th. Continued full-out oil production in the face of withering demand is a recipe for pushing oil prices downward worldwide. If the Gulf gets hit by another big hurricane this year, however, all bets are off. There are 6 weeks left in what's considered the Atlantic hurricane season. I'm Carl Ettinger, and that's this week's Peak Oil Check-In.
Peak Oil Check-In was produced by Relocalizing Vermont Productions in association with WGDR Plainfield.
Mr. President, do you have any comment on the fact that Senator Russ Feingold is holding a hearing on restoring the rule of law to establish steps the next president can take to restore the balance of power and repair all the damage to the Constitution that your administration has done?
I'm sorry, but you lost me at rule of what?
Rule of law.
Man, you are talking gibberish. You're in America. Speak English. Jeez.
In the midst of all that, what's the Bush administration doing? They're like, perfect. People are distracted. Let's go nuts. So now they've introduced a new, not legislation, because that would have to pass Congress, and they don't want to do that, new rules from the Justice Department for the FBI where they get to spy on you even more. You thought the illegal spying was bad before, wait till you get on the new ones. And all it has to do is pass by Michael Mukasey, the head of the Justice Department. Gee, I wonder if he'll say yes. He's been so independent before. He's a total Cheney rubber stamper. So, of course, this is going to pass. So I started reading the rules, and because I'm a naive young fellow, to this day I'm a little hopeful, and I thought, well, maybe they won't be so bad. And I started reading, and I thought, okay, okay. And then, of course, they got terrible. So let me explain. I'm going to quote the Washington Post here. The changes would give the FBI's more than 12,000 agents the ability at a much earlier stage to conduct physical surveillance, solicit informants, and interview friends of people they are investigating without the approval of a bureau supervisor. So, look, they're going to go to informants earlier. I don't really have a problem with that. There might be a good reason why some civil rights advocates might be against it, but That doesn't really offend me. Interview friends of people they're investigating without their approval of Bureau supervisors. That's a little troublesome because that means if some FBI agent's got it in his head that he doesn't like Jesus, even without checking without a court or even his supervisors, he can go start talking to all the friends of him and be like, hey, what's going on? And if the FBI comes around investigating you and goes and talks to all your family and friends, that can cause a lot of trouble for you. In fact, it can get you fired in a lot of places. So I'm already a little uncomfortable, but listen to the first thing they said. They can conduct physical surveillance without even asking their supervisors. Remember, before we needed warrants for this stuff. Remember when the Fourth Amendment and the Constitution applied? You would have to go to a court and say, hey, can I go ahead and get a warrant for physical surveillance? Now, not only do you not have to go to court, you don't even have to go to your supervisor. So any FBI agent could be like, yeah, all right, I'm going to go ahead and do physical surveillance. So already these new regulations suck. But they continue. Such techniques are currently available only after the FBI agents have opened an investigation and developed a reasonable suspicion that a crime has been committed or the threat to national security is developing. So under the new rules, you don't need a threat to national security. You don't need reasonable suspicion. You don't need anything. You don't need your supervisor. You don't need a court. You just go ahead and do whatever you like. I thought this was the United States of America, not a police state. It continues. Authorities say the changes would eliminate confusion for agents who investigate drug, gang, or national security cases. What confusion? What, the confusion of having to ask your supervisor or getting reasonable suspicion without going into wild fishing expeditions, ruining people's lives? But that's not even the disturbing part. Wait, I thought this was about terrorism. What the hell is the drug and gang stuff? Now, I'm against drug violence. I'm against gang violence. But all of a sudden, of course, all of these great powers that were needed after 9/11 are not just applied to these cases anymore, to terrorism cases anymore. They're applied to all cases. So they can do physical surveillance or go talk to all your friends without any reasonable suspicion or without checking with anybody. On any case. Has it gotten bad enough for you yet? No? I'll give you one more. Continuing to quote from the Washington Post explaining the new rule changes at the FBI that are going to take place in October. Quote, the overhaul touches on several sensitive areas. It would allow, for example, agents to interview people in the United States about foreign intelligence cases without warrants or prior approval of their supervisors. It would also rewrite the 1976 guidelines established after Nixon-era abuses that restrict the FBI's authority to intervene in times of civil disorder and to infiltrate opposition groups. You understand what that means? That means the FBI can go into any group they like in the U.S. as long as they call it an opposition group. Gee, I wonder which groups they're going to go into. You think they're going to go into right-wing groups, or could it be perhaps they're going to go into left-wing groups? And then they're going to say, oh, well, I don't know. They said they were for peace, but so we assumed they were an opposition group, and we had to investigate them. How do I know this? They already did it. Remember, they went after the Quakers? They went after PETA? Another group. I think it was a group of vegetarians, right? Vegans, that's what it was. They went after a bunch of vegans in San Francisco. Why? They're an opposition group. They had to be infiltrated. What does it mean in a democracy to be an opposition group? I mean, isn't that part and parcel of a democracy? Does it mean an opposition group as in they're going to overthrow the government? Or does it mean an opposition group to the government, which is perfectly legal, and which is what our whole system of government is based upon? These people are robbing us of all of our rights right underneath our nose. And we're looking around, Obama, McCain, Palin. What did Palin say to Charlie Gibson? Oh, we don't have the Fourth Amendment rights anymore? And the FBI, without checking with the supervisor or the courts, without a warrant, without reasonable suspicion, can just go in and do physical surveillance on you, talk to all your friends and family and your business associates, do an official investigation of you with no suspicion. That's not the America I know and love. These people, Michael Mukasey, the Attorney General, George W. Bush, Dick Cheney, and the entire Republican Party that signs off on this are America haters. They hate our form of government. They can't stand it. They want an authoritarian form of government. They don't want us to have our rights. They don't believe in the Fourth Amendment. They don't believe in the Bill of Rights. They don't believe in the Constitution. They don't think we should have a right for the government to be able to get a warrant before coming into our house. And by the way, one more thing on it. In times of civil disorder, What civil disorder? They're pretending as if there's some sort of great civil disorder in the country. They're like, oh, what could we do? We had to go in and violate all your rights and infiltrate opposition groups. There's no civil disorder. Look at what happened in St. Paul. The Republicans had a convention. About a couple of hundred, maybe a couple of thousand protesters. That's not fair. Maybe about 20,000 at max of protesters, 99% of which were completely civil, and a couple of ones that did something. And so they send in the SWAT teams, they send in the FBI, they infiltrate, and they go, oh, civil disorder, what can we do? We had to violate everybody's rights. They threw Amy Goodman in jail. This country is slipping out of control. And if another Republican wins, good night, Irene. Kiss your rights goodbye.